Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, bringing the facts, stories and people behind the science. Eddie Holmes, evolutionary biologist, fellow of the Academy of Sciences in Australia, and also fellow of the Royal Society, and winner of the 2021 Prime Minister's Prize for Science in Australia. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much.
Eddie, the reason why we're going to talk to you today is, I think, to understand a little bit about the evolution of coronaviruses and specifically where the pandemic virus SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 virus came from. But I think a good place to start is to understand a bit about you and how you got into studying viruses and their evolution. And in reading a bit about you, I read that you started off doing anthropology, and so perhaps more interested in people than in viruses.
Yeah, so at school, I actually didn't do any science A-levels. We had those back in our day. And I did kind of art subjects. And what I wanted at university, I wanted to do social anthropology, which is more like sort of culture and you know, kinship and that kind of thing, so social structures. While I was there, part of that course was biological anthropology, which is really science and zoology and genetics and evolution. And I thought, oh my God, this is actually much more interesting. In fact, I should say one more thing. At school, I gave up science because the teacher we had was a creationist and he wouldn't teach evolution. And so it was a forbidden thing. And suddenly at university, I was exposed to it. I thought, my gosh, it's actually really good. And so that's how I got into evolution, and that got me into kind of evolutionary genetics. And then I kind of drifted into the virus world.
But you went from your undergraduate degree in anthropology to then actually look at evolution in primates, which I think is what you studied in your PhD in Cambridge.
Yeah. So what happened was I did my PhD on primates, and then I went to do a postdocs and postdoctoral research like we all do in the US, the University of California in Davis. And I was working on Drosophila, on fruit flies, which are kind of the great models that geneticists use to work out how genes work. My day job was counting the bristles, like the hairs on the back of fruit fly kind of heads, to look at how it's controlled genetically. And I have to say,
I should just interrupt here and say that this is an audio podcast. So what people can't see is that, rather like me, you don't have very much hair, but you were pointing to the back of your head, trying to make a few bristles at the back.
A few bristles we have left, right? I have to say, I was a little bit bored doing that. While I was there, it's just close to San Francisco. This was in 1990. And this is the peak really of the AIDS deaths and California, San Francisco was obviously a hotspot for that. And while I was there, I spent a lot of time in San Francisco. And you could see it happening, this epidemic in your face. And it came to our lab, who was working on the evolution of HIV, the virus that caused AIDS. And it was just so interesting to me to what he was doing in the context of where I was living. And you kind of watch this virus evolving in real time, whereas in Drosophila and fruit flies, you're not doing that. And so I thought, I kind of literally packed up my fruit flies. I thought, right, I want to work on viruses because I can watch evolution happening. And it's of great societal importance. So I kind of flipped automatically from flies to viruses.
So was that sort of driven by the scientific interest, or does this sort of reach back into your past interested in human populations? Were you already thinking about how understanding the science might actually have an impact on our understanding of human health?
Yeah, I think so. I think what interests me for my anthropology, I think I was interested in the different sorts of social structures that humans have had through their evolutionary history, how that would have impacted the diseases they had got. Okay, and or been exposed to. I'm still quite interested in that. So as human societies evolve and our populations have grown and got more dense, we could become the first farmers or the first cities, all of those things would have changed the ability of viruses and the diseases to spread. I've always been kind of interested in that. And then I suddenly realized that looking at the virus side of things, because they evolve so much faster than we do, it just gives you that window on the basic processes of evolution. So it kind of fitted beautifully. And so I, you know, that literally overnight, a day in California in 1990, I devoted my life to viruses.
So if we think about viruses that just have a handful of genes compared with humans that have, what, 30,000 genes, something like that, what is the sort of numbers of genes with something like HIV that you're talking about that are involved in evolutionary process?
Yeah, about 10, I would say, 10 or 11.
And so with the study of evolution, I mean, you've got 10 genes to play with some of these viruses, or maybe maybe a few more with some of the bigger viruses. So what are you actually looking at over the course of the replication, so the production of new viruses? What are you looking at that tells you that they're evolving?
So the good side of the bad side of viruses is the same thing, and that's that they mutate extremely quickly. So we have these very small genomes, very small arrangement of genes, but every time they copy, every time they kind of make a photocopy of that genome, they make an error. Something goes wrong. Now, humans, we also make errors occasionally, but our genomes we have are so big, those errors are normally not very important. And we can also kind of correct them. We have kind of genetic machinery, it goes on and fixes, we have mechanics come along and kind of fix the errors. Viruses don't fix them. The errors just accumulate. And every time they copy, they make an error. And so for HIV, the AIDS virus, the amazing statistic is something like every single mutation is made every single day in every single person infected, which is just extraordinary. So they're just these evolutionary machines. They produce so much diversity. Now, of course, that's great if you're an evolutionary biologist. It's amazing because you can actually watch this evolution literally in real time over days. The bad thing is that mutational power allows them to adapt to new hosts or to evade vaccines maybe or antiviral drugs. So that mutational power, that's what makes them so important.
So with something like HIV, as you described, making mutations, and of course, that's not just one mutation for each of those 10 genes. It's within each gene, there's multiple mutations, which essentially end up with potentially a change in the virus, that it's doing something completely differently. So does that just make it impossible for these highly mutable viruses to ever really understand them and get on top of them, with particularly with vaccines, but also with drugs?
I think there is definitely a way we can do that. So they do mutate a lot. Now, the good thing is that most of those mutations are actually not good for the virus. They're what we call deleterious. They actually make them worse. If you think about it, if you've got such a small number of genes, they're so well packed and controlled and so well organized that most mutations don't actually make much difference. They don't make it any better. So in fact, there's very few evolutionary pathways these viruses can actually follow. So in some cases, like the influenza virus, we can almost kind of predict how it's going to evolve. Not perfectly, but you can definitely see it's constraining what it does because it's being buffeted by certain processes, which mean despite all that mutational diversity, it's only going to evolve certain pathways. Other cases are harder, but in some cases we can kind of predict certain things. So I do think we do have a chance, I think, to try and control them by interventions.
So I guess what you're saying is that if you're dealing with a gene that's making a viral protein that is critical for the virus to get into our cells, if it completely removes its ability to get into our cells by mutation, then it's a useless virus and that will never survive. But it could be that a mutation results in a virus that's better able to bind onto our cells, and therefore it might be fitter and overtake the previous generation.
Yeah, absolutely. As has happened with SARS-CoV-2. If you look at the virus we have today compared to the virus that we first saw in Wuhan in China in December 2019, they're very, very different beasts. The virus today is much more efficient at replicating in our bodies, produces many more copies of virus per unit time than the virus that first emerged. It's much better a human adapted virus. And we've seen that evolutionary process take place over the last sort of almost 4 years now.
So if you look at the various viruses that you've worked on, hepatitis C, you mentioned HIV and influenza, and I think dengue as well. So those viruses, and you're tracking their evolution, but they're making all these mistakes all the time, which they're not doing intentionally, just because they're rubbish at making good copies of themselves. So they're making mistakes all the time. How can you use that to work out where they've come from or look back into history about how long they've been in human populations?
As the beauty of mutation is, well, the bad side is, like I say, it makes lots of diversity. The beauty is, if you're an evolutionary biologist, those mutations are the fingerprints of where they come from. So what we can actually do is simply see whether, if two viruses sequences share the same mutation, that suggests they're related. And the more mutations they share, the more closely related they are. And that allows you to reconstruct like a family tree of all these viruses. And those family trees can be of all the viruses ever made. They can be of certain family of viruses like the coronaviruses, or they can be of different variants of a virus like SARS-CoV-2. So tracing the patterns mutation, how many they share, which mutations they share between them, you can reconstruct the evolutionary history. And you can do that very accurately. You can also do it in real time. That's the amazing thing. And so for SARS-CoV-2, what that ability to reconstruct family trees, that was being used as a way of seeing how the virus is spreading through populations. You know, where did that outbreak come from? What strain brought it in? We can reconstruct that. And that gives you then the power to try and have interventions that are targeted based on that information. So it's actually a very powerful thing.
And if we look at that question, which I know you've been interested in your career, which is how viruses come from other species to humans, are you able to determine what species they've come from by our ability to look across those mutations in the genome of the virus?
Absolutely. In theory, we can do that. So it's the same idea. The closer two viruses are between two different species, so the more mutations they share, the more likely that one gave it to the other. So in some cases, we can work that out really well. So for example, HIV, the AIDS virus, we've known since the mid-1990s that the closest viruses are found in chimpanzees. So that's very, very strong evidence that chimpanzees are, they're a virus that's the ancestor of human HIV. In other cases, we really don't know yet. And a really good example would be something like hepatitis C virus that infects millions of people globally. And there's lots of liver transplants needed because of that. We don't know where that virus comes from. There's still nothing that's close enough to say, aha, that's what the ancestor is. And in fact, humans have got something like 250, 300 viruses ever infected humans we know about. And of those, I would say probably only a handful, you know, maybe 10, maybe we actually know exactly where they come from. The others, we're not entirely sure. So in fact, more often than not, we don't know where something comes from.
And I think in the case of chimpanzees, because with HIV, there are different variants of the virus, we can actually determine that there's more than one introduction into humans.
Absolutely. So it's actually quite a complicated story. So HIV comes in two types, HIV1, HIV2. HIV1 is the dominant one. HIV2 is mainly found in West Africa. And we think HIV2 jumped from a monkey species called a sooty mangabe, which is quite common monkeys in this part of Africa. And that probably jumped multiple times to humans. HIV1, we think, as you suggested, that also jumped multiple times to humans, usually from chimps, but there's some other strains of HIV1 that may have come from gorillas. Okay. We don't know exactly how that happened. It probably happened at the start of the 20th century, and it's probably bushmeat. People were hunting animals, hunting chimpanzees, and they probably cut themselves whilst butchering the animal, got some blood that got infected. But it's happened multiple times, actually, which is really, really quite extraordinary.
With this constrained mutation, not that the mutation is constrained, but it's constrained in what survives and that allows you to track evolution, how does that then feed into our ability to actually make drugs for HIV or for hepatitis C or even vaccines for them?
So because diversity is not endless, because there's a cap to it, because only certain mutations ever can work, that means the number of targets you would need for a vaccine and a drug is actually smaller than you might think, okay? So viruses can't do everything. They can juggle a few balls, but they can't do everything. So for HIV, for example, the virus can get resistant to one drug very easily. So in the old, back in the 90s, they had one or two drugs they used to treat HIV patients, and the virus could escape those very easily. If you put three or four drugs in, it really can't do it because you're making it juggle all these balls simultaneously, and it can't do it. So they can't adapt to everything. If we give them enough evolutionary challenges, enough antivirals or the right vaccines, they cannot always respond. So there's definitely targets. For vaccines, as you well know more than me, it's not just about the number of options. It's about producing a good immune response against the virus as well. So it's actually another level of complexity that comes into it.
So we often talk about the various aspects of the environment that are driving mutation. And of course, part of the environment is the human immune response or the drugs that we're using. So how do those influence what we then see in mutation in viruses?
What the environment does, in this case, it can be, and that environment can be drugs we use, or it can be vaccines, or it can be the host. Okay, there's different hosts and different environments. What they do is they are natural selection. So they're actually, they don't drive mutation, but they dictate what mutations survive. Okay, so for example, a mutation that arises in a cell in a chimpanzee may work in a chimpanzee, but it may not work in a human. mutation that works in the face of one drug may not work in the face of another drug. And selection is the sieve. It sifts through those mutations and determines which ones survive. Now, in the case of SARS-CoV-2, what that sieve of natural selection, what it's done, it's clearly now fixed mutations that allow the virus to evade immunity. And you can see that with Omicron. The Omicron variant that came in the end of 2021, that virus is definitely can escape our immune response that was produced before that, because snatched selections that favor the variant that allows it to evade immunity. So these environments, cells, drugs, vaccines, there's a selective sieve that pulls out the right mutations for the virus to survive.
So in the long run, with these viruses which make a lot of mistakes, does that make it impossible that we'll ever be able to fully control them because they've always got escape mechanisms? Or do you think that there are ways in which people like you will be able to tell us what are the right drug targets that cannot be escaped?
Yeah, so that is an extremely hard question. So they can't, viruses can't, they are extremely adaptable, but they're not perfect Darwinian machines, okay? They don't live forever. They don't produce endless offspring. There are constraints on what they can do. And they give us a target. It gives us a chance. It's like I say, for HIV, vaccines have really not been successful to date, but antiviral therapy has been amazing. And that antiviral therapy has been based on hitting multiple drugs, hitting different parts of the virus life cycle. Because we understand viral biology, understand virus evolution, we can better direct our intervention strategies to control them. SARS-CoV-2, we need to watch how that's going to go in the next few years, but it will always be there. It will always evolve. Hopefully, vaccines, we can produce them targeted enough to cope with any new variant that might arise.
Yeah, I guess the problem there is that rather, as you said before, we need to be able, like with flu, to get better at predicting what the next variant is, because largely we're making vaccines for the variant we've already had rather than the one we're about to get. So that's going to be quite an issue. And I think the point you made about HIV, when we first started treating patients with HIV, we were using a single drug, and very rapidly that then selected variants that were resistant to that drug.
Within weeks, yeah. It was extraordinarily rapid, yeah.
Now we're getting control of the virus using drugs for years, decades. I mean, it's quite remarkable how it's changed.
Over our lifetime, you know, from my first experience of the virus in California in 1990 to where we are now, the virus has changed from, I mean, it was effectively a death sentence, to now it's a controllable, almost chronic condition. And the drugs have been absolutely miraculous. And so, yeah, you know, people can live with this disease like a normal life. So it has completely changed. Prediction is a critical thing, as you suggested, but it's turned out to be very, very hard. And so hopefully in the future, with things like AI coming on board and with lots of information, we can predict more accurately. But it is a great challenge. It really is.
So you found yourself as someone interested in viruses when the pandemic began, which really for most of us began in 2020, but obviously the virus is around before that. So what were you doing that sort of got you right in the center of all of this, in being involved as you were in the very first sequences that were published of the virus?
It was serendipity. So what happened was, I had a colleague in China called Professor Zhang, who works in Shanghai now. And we had a collaboration for a number of years looking at virus evolution and diversity and disease emergence in China. And what he had done was set up various field sites around the country that we could go and sample humans and animals in their local areas. And one of those sites, by chance, is Wuhan. Okay. And in Wuhan, we had collaborators at the Wuhan CDC, Center for Disease Control, and Wuhan Central Hospital. Now, if you can think back to your TV screens in January 2020, those early patients you would have seen in Wuhan, if you remember, many of them have been at Wuhan Central. And by chance, we were working with doctors at the respiratory disease ward in that hospital. And with Wuhan CDC, we had a collaboration that was sampling animals and patients around Wuhan. And as part of that, I'd been to this very famous Hawaiian seafood market in the city, a wet market, and it really isn't a seafood market. When I was there, it had, you know, a variety of mammals. We'll discuss that later on, but a variety of other wildlife were there. So the plan was, what we were going to do was sample humans and wildlife in this city. We were going to use a technique called metagenomics to find out all the microbes that these people had. Okay, so not just the viruses, the bacteria and the fungi. And we were particularly going to work on people who had pneumonia or acute respiratory disease, okay, by chance. And so we were in the right place with the right technique and the right patient group to work on this. So we set that up in 2016. And then during New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2019, I saw a post online a place called ProMed's website that gives you kind of daily outbreak information about disease outbreaks all over the world. And I saw this report and it said there are 4 cases of undiagnosed pneumonia. We don't know what the cause is in Wuhan associated with this particular wet market. And I thought, oh, hang on, I've been to Wuhan. I've been to that wet market. We're working on pneumonia. I better contact Zhang. So I emailed Zhang immediately. And he, in fact, well, I only heard from him the other day, actually. I didn't know this. He hadn't heard about this until I told him, which is quite extraordinary. And so he said, I'm not working on this yet. So then a few days later, I got this email that said, January the 5th, said, please call me immediately. We got 4 exclamation points, right? What happened in the interim period is that he talked to his colleagues at Wuhan Central Hospital and Wuhan CDC. They had some early cases. All these patients had been associated with this wet market and they'd been admitted to the hospital in late December. And he'd arranged that their samples, it's actually a lung water, so a deep kind of lung sample, was to be sent to him on a train from Wuhan to Shanghai. So someone put a package on a train of these samples and it was shipped across China to his lab in Wuhan. It arrived on January the 3rd. Okay, so I prompted him January the 3rd. And then they set about sequencing the virus on their machine. And 40 hours later, so about 2 a.m. in the morning of January the 5th, they got the sequence. Okay, and that's kind of where it all started.
They knew immediately it was a coronavirus.
Yes. So what happened was, so we got the sequences back. We had 7 patients. Of those 7, only one of them had a virus, but it was a huge abundance and lots of copies of this virus in the lungs. And the virus was new and it looked like the first SARS virus that we've had in 2002, 2003. So we kind of went, oh, you know, beep. SARS is back. So immediately we hadn't proven causation, but it was so kind of obvious that must be it because it was so much like SARS one.
Yeah, SARS being the virus that had caused outbreaks in Southeast Asia 20 years before, but actually had gone away because that one didn't seem to transmit very well between humans.
Absolutely. So the difference was, so SARS one first appeared in Guangdong province in China, in southern China, in November or so 2022, caused an outbreak, and I think it infected about 8,000 people globally in a few countries, and then burnt out, as you said. The difference was it wasn't so infectious, and people only transmitted when they were symptomatic. Of course, SARS-2 is much more infectious, and people were transmitted when they were asymptomatic, which is the kind of worst-case scenario, so a much worse beast. So we could see that virus was like SARS-1 immediately. And that meant all the alarm bells kind of kicked off at that point. Now, I should say, very importantly, we were not the first people to sequence this. And the doctors in Wuhan, what they had done in the few days before, in late December, they had seen these cases. They, like any clinician would do, they ran them through their panel of diagnostic tests. They have standard tests for viruses and bacteria. And they were failing to detect what it was. It wasn't coming as positive. So they sent it off to a local biotech company who did the same thing as Zhang did a few days later. They did this metagenomic sequencing and they then found that there was this novel virus too. So the first genome sequence was actually obtained December 27th, 2019.
When did you or did they realize that it was a novel virus rather than just the original SARS again?
We knew right from the get-go it was like SARS-1 and about 80% similar. Now, the rules for a virus is, you know, when is it novel, when is it not novel? 80%, you would normally say if it's 95% or less similar, then it's a novel virus. So we knew it was novel, but it was so much like SARS-1. I mean, Zhang was calling it SARS, okay? And so what happened was, so we talked on the phone on the 5th, literally a few hours after he got the virus back. And I read by email to him, and I said to him, you've got to go and tell the Ministry of Health what you found. This is very important. So he wrote them a letter. And he said, we have a new virus. It's like SARS-1. It's likely to be respiratory because SARS-1 is respiratory. And people should take precautions. Okay. And so though it took a few weeks to formally prove there was human transmission of this virus, to us, because it was so like SARS-1 and coronaviruses tend to be mammalian and respiratory, we kind of thought this is not going to be a virus because they've eaten, you know, haddock that's infected. This is going to be a respiratory virus. We could kind of see that from the gene sequence.
And you'd found a lot of it in the lungs.
Oh, lots of it in the lungs. Absolutely lots of it in the lungs, yeah.
So you've now got the sequence. What did you do in making that public? And, you know, had the biotech company already moved that on themselves?
No, so no one had made it public. So I think there was certainly a lot of rumour going around, but there was absolutely no public release. And for better or worse, the authorities in China were trying to... they put like an embargo on information, on publishing information about the outbreak. And I think they wanted officially to kind of like calm public, you know, not to have any panic that was in the population. So they'd made it quite strict rules about not communicating anything. But we kind of had this information. So, you know, and Zhang was in a very position because he wanted to tell people. I mean, he wanted to get a paper, right? We all wanted the first paper, as scientists do, right? So, you know, we wrote a paper very quickly, but we were kind of under this bind that we weren't meant to do anything. But there was rumor and counter rumor going around. Then on, I think it was January the 9th, the Chinese officials announced that it was a coronavirus, but they didn't say what it was. And there was no genome sequence that was announced. And then the next day, Jeremy Farrar, who was the director of the Wellcome Trust, who's an old friend of mine, he put a thing on Twitter saying, I hear rumors that there's a paper about the virus, but there's no published genome sequence of the virus. To me, that's wrong. And I thought, oh, darn, you know, that's me. I've got the data. I need to do something about this. And so, in fact, I hadn't actually got the sequence myself. So I frantically got hold of Zhang and said, we have to release this sequence now. We have to do this. It's like the public health. We've told authorities in China, but we have to make this global. And, you know, he bravely said, okay. So he gave me the sequence, and then I scrambled and wrote a little bit of text around it. And we actually had, well, there were some complaints early on that we didn't put the date of sampling or the patient's age or like, we had all the information. But at that point, I thought that might be personally identifiable because there are very few cases. I didn't want to give away who this actually was. So we kind of removed all the information and just put, this is a sequence of the virus from Wuhan. And then with a colleague of mine, Andrew Rambo from the University of Edinburgh, we posted it on his website and I put it on Twitter. And then that became like the first sequence that was then now the reference sequence that the smart people came along and designed vaccines for.
Do you think that to some extent, the reticence of the Chinese at that point was wanting to confirm that it was real? Because I guess one sequence doesn't prove an epidemic.
Absolutely right. Yeah, I think they were being very cautious. I don't think they're to blame much in that respect. And I think if you think about it also, in SARS-1, which I remember very well, there were a number of false dawns. I mean, initially, I think some people claimed it was a metapneumovirus, okay? And there were a number of myths, you know, it was wrongly called a number of times. So they didn't want public panic. And I think the word SARS was going to be toxic, I think. And what also happened, I should say, is in the interim period, just before we sequenced it, one of the technicians at this biotech company, she had posted on Chinese social media a report saying SARS is back. Okay. And they actually showed a screenshot of the sequencing run, the actual technical data from this genetic, this retrogenic sequencing. And that went around Chinese social media. Okay. So that was going to cause some degree of public panic as well. So there was a number of different reasons for why that kind of happened.
So this is around about the 9th of January, I think you were saying, that finally the sequence is public.
Yeah, well, I put it online on the 11th of January, Sydney time. It was the evening of the 10th, the US time.
Yeah. And so I think we were first aware of the sequence in Oxford on the 11th of January. So that just shows how quickly it gets around the world.
This is Twitter. It was, I mean, you know, Twitter for or X, I should call it now, for all its, you know, in recent times, its problems, which are well documented. During the first days of the pandemic, it drove the conversation. It drove the science, actually. And people were, there was a great, I mean, you must have seen it. There was a great thing where people were sharing the data immediately on social media. So it was a great thing. It worked very well.
And expressing opinions, which sometimes were positive and sometimes not. Now, so that sort of gets the sequence out. But of course, very soon after that, the controversy about where did it come from started. And I think an important area, which was actually a lot on Twitter as well, was about this mysterious furin cleavage site and how that proved it must have come from a laboratory. Now, I think we know that that's not the case, but can you just explain what we mean by a furin cleavage site, not in too much technical detail, and then why that probably is an irrelevance here?
Yeah, that's the most important little bit of sequence, possibly controversial ever determined. So if you think about this virus, we've all heard the spike protein on the outer surface of the virus. That spike protein, the sequence of that spike protein is in two pieces, and the two pieces, a little hinge between them, okay? They're called S1 and S2, and they're joined by a hinge. And that furin cleavage site occurs at a little tiny bit of gene sequence, four amino acids, so just type 12 nucleotides that occurs at that hinge. And what that does, that allows that hinge to be opened more easily, if you like. And that allows the virus to get into cells more efficiently. Okay, the door is open more for the cell more efficiently. And that allows the virus to reproduce more and become more infectious and then to spread easier. So it's actually a really important mutation for allowing the virus to spread efficiently in human cells and other species too. Now, it's called a furin cleavocyte because this little bit of sequence is recognized by an enzyme called furin, okay? That's why it's called a furin cleavocyte.
So enzymes are a type of protein.
Yeah, it's a protein. So it's a protein that helps, like I say, it cleaves, it that opens this pathway in the virus. Now, these furin cleavocytes, they occur very commonly in viruses, okay? So they're very common in influenza viruses. They're common in other coronaviruses. They come and go in evolution all the time, so they're not unusual. The reason why this one caused such controversy is because SARS-CoV-2 is related to a group of bat viruses, and none of these have the furin cleavocyte. The only one that does in that group is SARS-CoV-2. And because these bat viruses, some of them come from a laboratory in Wuhan, so only about 30 kilometers from where the viruses were detected, many people have said, aha, they must have been engineering that cleavocyte in the virus. And there's a lab escape, and that's what's caused this pandemic.
And does that make sense from your perspective that that is a likely source then?
No, I think the probability of that happening is effectively zero. I think the reasons why are, again, furin cleavocytes are natural things. They come and go in viruses all the time. And I don't think this virus would have been pandemic if it hadn't got a furin cleavocyte. And evolution picks them up, okay? I suspect it was picked up in another, not a bat, but another animal species. To cut a very long story short, it's a very, very, very long story. That, you know, if the virus came from that lab, you'd expect to find it in that lab before the pandemic. Now, that's a simple thing. They should have had that virus and been playing with it. And there's absolutely no evidence for that at all. There's nothing from papers, from PhD theses, from emails, social media, nothing. There's simply no talk. And then because of that, then you get into this kind of conspiracy of how they were doing it in secret or working with the military. It becomes more and more implausible. And there's no reason why they would have worked on that virus, because what they were focused on was SARS-1. And we now know, so the evidence for the lab is basically non-existent. We now know that, in fact, at this market where the virus was first detected, okay, and again, SARS-1 was detected in a live animal market, and so was SARS-2. And I've been to this market. It's not a very crowded market. And so it's not a great hub of humanity. It's a low-density animal market. So we know that that virus was first found in this animal market, and we know the key animals were also there, okay? So all that to me suggests this is just another zoonotic virus. It comes from animals and it's got into humans because of the way we live today. And I very strongly suspect this is the wildlife trade.
Is there evidence that the virus was actually there in other animals in the market that you've seen?
So what we do know now very clearly, so this is actually very interesting stuff. So the market was closed on January the 1st, 2020. The authorities came in then and they wanted to do an outbreak investigation. So they took swabs of lots of surfaces. They did, you know, bench tops and door handles and drains and freezers and cages and everything you could think of. They then tested those swabs for the virus later on, okay? And they also did some sequencing to see what was in those swabs. And what that told us was that not just the virus was there all over that market, but there were also lots of animals there, because that gene sequence contains not just a virus, but also what animal DNA there is. So we've got hedgehogs, we've got civets, we've got raccoon dogs, we've got porcupines. There's a huge array of animals that are in that market. And the same locations where you find the virus in the market, you find the animals. Okay, now we haven't found yet as an infected animal. We do know they've co-occurred. Interesting that we've also found is that there's also other animal viruses in there as well. Okay, amazingly, there's a very nasty strain of influenza called H9N2. That was also in the market. There are also raccoon dogs viruses in the market. Okay, so this is kind of like a petri dish, you know, a laboratory dish of viruses, kind of in soup in that particular market.
In animals, waiting to jump into
humans, absolutely. And so, you know, my model, and I do think, and just like SARS-1, and I do think that what disease emergence is, it's what I call the animal-human interface. It's where we interact with wildlife, okay? That's the threat. And the more porous that is, the bigger that risk is. And in many countries, not just China, in many countries, there's a thriving wildlife trade. Okay. And sometimes that's illegal. And there are lots of animals kept in very bad conditions, crowded on top of each other. People handle them. The animals are sick. People handle them wearing no gloves. And that exposure happens all the time. And what I suspect happened was the virus was in bats, probably not in China, but some parts of Southeast Asia, maybe Laos or Cambodia or Myanmar, Thailand. It then got into another animal that's trafficked as a wildlife trade, like a raccoon dog or a civet. And that's what brought it into the market. And it got into that market in Wuhan and it jumped into people there. And then pandemic.
So it's evolution that might have introduced the furin cleavage site could have happened in those other mammals before they ever got to the market.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that's very interesting is at the moment, these furin cleavage sites are not found in many bats, okay? Which tells me that bats don't actually need that bat viruses don't need that virus in fed bats. So I strongly suspect it got into these intermediate species. And we know that pangolins are infected too, okay? And it cannot just be bats and pangolins. There'll be lots of other animals in this chain we haven't yet sampled. I think that furin cleavage site was picked up by evolution, by natural evolution, that sieve we talked about before, in these wildlife species, in that wildlife train, and that trade brought it into the market.
So, Eddie, you've come under quite a bit of scrutiny because of showing the first sequence and then trying to understand how the virus might have jumped from an animal species. How has that felt for you, being sort of under the spotlight and with people attacking you for trying to share your science?
Tough. It really is tough because, you know, I'd like to be like a backroom person. That's what I consider myself. I'm not the lead singer of the band. I'm kind of like the back playing the bass kind of thing. I never thought I was going to be in that position. And suddenly you're thrust into this and then... Part of that was positive because of sequence relief, but then the origin stuff has been extraordinarily negative. And I think many people had it worse than me, but it was a bit of a shock. Now I'm kind of like a bit thick-skinned to it, actually. I'm kind of used to it. To me, though, I think the key point is not just me, actually. It's the fact that what this has done has politicized the whole field. This, to me, is the real worry now. And so what, we want to learn lessons from COVID to make not this won't happen again. We will get outbreaks again, but we can kind of control them better. Now, the science side of it's gone wonderfully. I mean, vaccines, like yourself, phenomenal. I mean, incredible development of vaccines so quickly. Sequencing of pathogens, amazing. We can identify them so quickly now. It took 40 hours for Zhang to find SARS-CoV-2. It took 2 years to find the HIV equals days, right? Amazing. The problem is that despite all that wonderfulness, the politics is getting worse and worse by the day. And what concerns me is if you want to have stop the next pandemic, we have to have global kind of cooperation, collaboration, sharing data as freely and openly as possible. And what really worries me now is that we'll have an outbreak somewhere in the world, and people won't talk about it because they're scared of being blamed. They're scared of the finger being pointed at them. Okay, because the blame culture is so strong now. And that really worries me.
Well, I really hope that is not the case in future outbreaks and that we are just as on the front foot as we were this time with this pandemic. And as you say, it's a pretty remarkable scientific achievement to have got there. And you know, and it's wonderful that you've been a key part of that. Before we end, I'd be interested to know, what do you think you might have ended up doing if you hadn't become an evolutionary biologist studying viruses? Where do you think your life might have taken you?
Gosh, that is a great question. Well, you know, I had dreams of being some sort of rock star as a youngster. You know, I still play a lot of guitar now. That's my kind of hobby.
So is it a bass guitar that you're playing in the background?
No, I do, actually it's not. I say to say I'm shallower than I do actually try and play lead guitar, actually.
So we don't believe any of it now when you say you like being in the back room.
And it's slightly to the side of the front, man. I'd never be the Jagger. I'd be more the kind of, you know, maybe Keith Richards is a bad example. You know, I'd be more to the side. But so maybe I'd like to do that, but I don't know, really. I've been in the science games for a long time now, and I can't think of doing much else. Despite all the, you know, the bad press and the kind of online attacks, I mean, you wake up every day, you do something different, you learn something new. It's an amazing thing, right? And then, you know, I didn't think I would ever do anything of an evolution. You don't really think about doing things that are practically useful. You think about it as just knowledge for knowledge's sake. But the fact that I could do something like that was great. So I love what I do.
And I think the future almost certainly is going to be the science of evolution, and sequencing is going to be right there centrally to everything we do.
Absolutely.
In the future. Apart from playing an almost lead guitar, what else do you do in your spare time to get away from it all?
A lot of guitar. So it's actually been fun. I mean, you know, it's been all consuming. 2020 was, I'm sure it was even worse for you, was absolutely full on. And I don't think I've actually recovered from that almost. And at the moment, I have to say the SARS-CoV, the origins thing is so all encompassing. Every day there is something. Every day. And it's become a bit of an election issue as well in the US election. So I just try and bury myself by learning some new guitar scales just to kind of relax my brain from what's going on.
Great. So apart from working on gene sequences and thinking about nucleotides in your sleep, a bit of guitar is the Eddie Holmes.
Absolutely. You all need a bit of therapy somewhere. Yeah, absolutely.
Eddie Holmes, evolutionary biologist, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure.
That was the Oxford Colloquy. Thanks for joining us in our podcast, bringing you the facts, stories, and people behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? We've called this podcast series the Oxford Colloquy. Well, a colloquy is a discourse or a conversation, and hopefully you'll agree that that's what we've been having.